Good afternoon. So last time we started by looking at the POSIX API for threads, which is called pthreads. We saw equivalence to the functions we were using for managing processes. So instead of fork, we had pthread create. This was probably the most different from what we had for processes. So instead of returning twice to the same place, pthread create took a function to run, and that function would be what the new thread would run to completion, unless it exited early somehow. We had our equivalent of wait, which was join. And unlike with processes, we didn't have this how did it exit and an exit code if it called exit. We have just a pointer get returned through join, though most of the time we won't actually end up using that pointer, at least in my examples. And we had an exit function, pthread exit, which is like exit, but only exits one thread instead of the entire process, I mean, all the threads contained in it. We looked at several examples of how you might pass values to pthreads, which I went through because a lot of people look at, oh, I have to pass a void star pointer. How do I use that to do anything? And we saw that there were several strategies for that. We could just convert a number to a pointer, or more flexibly, we could allocate some structure and pass a pointer to that structure. Possibly we might need to put that structure on the heap if we wanted to make sure it stayed around for a while. Then we talked about, well, we were just doing things where we started a thread, waited for it to finish, and then looked at what happened after that. And that there's a lot of things we can do that way, but often we might want to coordinate what two threads do at a finer granularity, that something other than wait for the entire thread to finish. And to do that, we need to figure out, well, when two threads are working on the same thing, what's going to happen? And we have this concept of an atomic operation, that there are things we hope happen all together or not at all. We don't want an in-between state. And we saw the example of, like, if we're editing values, we'd like it to be the case that, you know, we see the new value or the old value when we're checking that from elsewhere, not something in between. And we saw that that wasn't the case with even individual instructions like an add, that wasn't atomic, that we could see some in-between state where the value hasn't changed, but we had retrieved the value to add already. And this meant we got a result which perhaps wasn't what we were expecting and would make it harder for us to have two threads acting on the same value. So we said, okay, we need things to be atomic, and we said, well, probably we can assume that writing or reading single values in memory, that's going to be atomic. And I said that had a real-world analogy of, like, reading and writing notes. So we looked at, well, if we're reading and writing notes, can we, you know, get two threads to coordinate? And the operation we wanted to coordinate is that exactly one thread checks for something and does it. Our example was we check if we have milk, and if, you know, we need to buy milk, therefore, and if so, bought milk. And we saw that, well, it's technically possible to do this sort of coordination, but really tricky. And we mentioned, we're not going to be doing that. We want better tools. It's not going to be good enough for the hardware to just give us this atomic load and store operation. It's just not powerful enough. And we still want this type of coordination. And the type of coordination we're going to start talking about is what we call mutual exclusion, that we have two threads, and at most one of them does an operation at a time. And our operation, our first example, was like check for milk. If there is no milk, buy milk. All that should happen one at a time. And we have other examples you can think of, like adding to a number. We should read the old number, compute the sum, and store the new sum. That could all happen one at a time. That would be an atomic add. So we do it with mutual exclusion to implement that. And we call the set of code where we have mutual exclusion, where one thread at a time does it, a critical section. And we have this abstraction called locks, which is going to be how we're going to actually implement that. So something is going to give us this abstraction called locks. I'll talk a little today about the simplest ways of implementing locks. And probably next time we'll talk about better ways of implementing locks. We need to look at what a lock is. So I'm going to go look at, review locks in a little more in a bit, but first, questions about anything else we covered last time. Okay, so we talked about our idea of a lock primitive. So we have this acquire operation where we wait until a lock is free and then grab it. And we have this release operation where we let others use the lock. We make the lock free. So the lock is either taken or not taken. There's no in between. And when it's taken, there's exactly one thread we can point to which has it. And that's necessary so we have our mutual exclusion property. So with our milk example, we have a lock for checking for and buying milk. And we get the lock before we started doing that, release it afterwards. And from this, we know that, you know, we take churns doing this checking and buying. And we wouldn't have an in-between state, which would cause confusion. So there are some APIs for implementing these locks. So one, pthreads, has a version of locks called a mutex. We'll talk more about what mutex means a little later. That's a particular kind of lock. And so this is an example of using it. Instead of doing this init, we could have also initialized the lock to a special constant called pthread mutex initializer. You can see the exact spelling in the manual page. But either we initialize it to the special constant or call this init function to set up the mutex. And then there's a lock and an unlock operation. And that's how we use pthread. So this is an alternative, is to declare the lock equal to this special constant. But one of those things to set up the lock, and then we lock and unlock it. So we like, XV6 has locks called spin locks. We'll talk later today about what is a spin lock, what particular kind of lock that is. So they're represented by a struct. You declare the struct, and you have to have some function initialize it. Typically, this is done in code which is called at boot. Unlike pthread mutex locks, there's no alternative to do this without some code which runs at boot. You have to do it. Have some code run at boot. And then there's an acquire and release operation. That's why I gave both the acquire and lock, same thing. Release and unlock, same thing. Why I gave both names. So questions on this API. These APIs here. Our pthreads API and our spinlock API. So the name lock seems to imply that I should be telling you to think of a lock like locking a door or something. And I think that's a pretty bad analogy because of an important thing about locks. So locks are about, when we use them, we have some sort of agreement. So I think of locks more like a flag. So I have like a little flag that I put on my table. And when we want to do something, I agree that I'm going to grab the flag, and then I'm allowed to do it. And only if I have the flag can I do it. And when I'm done doing it, I put the flag back on the table so you can get it. So our acquire or lock operation is look at the table, wait for there to be a flag. When there is, grab it. And the release operation is put the flag back on the table. And why I like this analogy better is this is an agreement, right? Whoever holds the flag can do that only because we agreed on that, not because anything is going to stop me from doing anything because I don't have the flag. Like, the flag doesn't actually let me do anything. This is just a voluntary agreement that I'm not going to manipulate that shared resource. You know, I'm not going to check for milk. I'm not going to increment the number without the lock. But it's not generally going to be enforced. There are types of locks where we'd enforce that, but we're not any of the locks we're going to talk about. It's just all voluntary, and you as a coder are responsible for making sure you follow this agreement. You agree with this among all your threads, and you actually do it. If you don't, well, too bad. Bad things are going to happen. So questions?
Is it possible that a lock is simultaneously held by multiple threads?
Question is it possible that a lock is simultaneously held by multiple threads? No.
So
that's not something we're going to support because I say we wait until it's free, then grab it. Yeah, and we're going to enforce that that you can't have two threads grab it simultaneously. That's going to be disallowed.
Right, but the agreement just kind of gives me an impression that the resources are still being shared.
So the question is, the agreement gives you the impression the resources are still being shared, and you're wondering, doesn't that mean the lock could be shared? So the lock can't be shared, but the lock, in this case our flag, is completely separate from the resource. So I have the flag which says I'm allowed to check for milk.
Right.
I can wave that all I want, but that doesn't stop Alice from walking past me and checking for milk.
Okay. But even in that scenario, would it be possible for multiple threads to access the same resource at the same time?
Question is, would it still be possible for multiple threads to access the same resource? So that depends on the resource. But when we're using locks, generally, the locks are not going to actually prevent it by themselves. The only reason that multiple threads won't access the resource at the same time is because they've all followed the same protocol, same procedure of always getting a lock first. And if they don't do that, multiple threads will try to use the resource at the same time. And depending on the resource, bad things might happen. Like we saw the example of trying to increment a number, and we didn't actually get the number we expected. Okay, answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah.
Is it possible that you have two threads running at the same time on two different cores trying to get the lock?
Question is it possible that we could have two threads running on two different cores trying to get the lock at the exact same time? Yes. And a correct lock will implement it such that only one of them gets it. And we'll talk about how it works later today. Yes? The question is, when it's waiting for a lock, is it in the same state as waiting for IO? So that's going to depend on the kind of lock we're using. So the kind of lock we'll talk about today and the kind of lock that I talked about in XV6 called spin locks, the answer is no. But we'll realize that that's not a very satisfying answer. So we'll have the other kind of lock, mutexes, where the answer is yes. Okay, answer your question. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, when a lock is released, does this send out an interruption? That, again, depends on the kind of lock and how it's implemented. So there are multiple correct choices. Okay, other questions? Nope, okay. So now that we know about locks, I'd like to talk about how we use locks in one particular case. And this is a specific example of a common case is that you have some sort of library you want to use for multiple threads, and that's your shared resource, and you need to figure out, when do I need to lock? I'll talk about this with the C++ standard library. So C++ has a vector class, which is a dynamic array, if you're not super familiar with C++. So it's a class that just wraps an array that is resized on demand. And to think about, can we use it for multiple threads? Like, it seems like we kind of need to know how it's implemented. So you might say it's a dynamically allocated array, and whenever the size of the vector changes, the size of the array changes, so it's reallocated. And our primary concern for safety is that we don't want to reallocate it, and this leads to a problem. What if thread is using the old version while someone else reallocates? So we have this concern that there's the, when we change the size, it's reallocated. So, but what if someone else is trying to access the non-reallocated version while the reallocation is happening? That's going to be a big problem, even if we're accessing different parts of the vector. Even if I'm accessing element 0 and you're appending to a big vector, like the reallocation means that element 0, now I'm accessing something that doesn't, that's invalid, that might be freed, you know, it might have changed. So that's bad. So this gives us sort of an idea of what the rule might be for when we have to worry about having mutual exclusion, you know, keeping one thread at a time, which is that we don't want things to, we don't want to have to worry about this reallocation. That when that reallocation happens, it's dangerous to be accessing the vector because we might be confused about what's the current array. And we want to make sure that we don't have one thread accessing one array and one thread accessing another. So you might say, okay, our rule is going to be I can access the vector for multiple threads as long as it's not being appended, erased from, and so on, as long as the size isn't changing. Because, you know, as long if I'm accessing separate elements, that shouldn't be a problem. If I'm reading only, that shouldn't be a problem. But this assumes something about how the vector is implemented. And there's something we can't really depend on. So let's say the vector, we resize it, the vector, when we make it bigger, and we have this policy that we're going to resize it but be very big, and we're going to shrink it if that doesn't work out. So that would be a reasonable way of implementing a vector where we'd have to worry about being reallocated when we're only reading from the vector, because it would be reallocated because it's been a while since you resized it and we didn't need all that extra space. We can shrink it. That's a reasonable way of implementing it. And it seems like, gosh, we need to know that that's not happening in order to figure out how to use this vector. And the solution that the C++ standard uses, and almost all libraries use, is that they're going to tell you what they're going to guarantee about how you can use it for multiple threads. And only because they tell you are you going to know what's safe. And what C++ has chosen is that they're going to make it so that if it's implemented this way, it has to use a lock to make that safe. So the rule in the C++ standard is multiple threads can read anything at the same time, as long as no other thread is modifying it, and they can safely add and remove elements from any of the containers only if no other threads are touching the container. So these are the rules they've set. There's some extra cases you can look up. But we only know this because the C++ standard library people have told us, yes, I know I'm implementing things so this works. That if I need to do extra work to make this true, I'm going to do it. So it might mean that if they want to do something fancy in their container, their vector, or their map implementation, they might have to do locking in there, but they're going to do that for you. And if you didn't have a guarantee like this, you'd have to assume the worst. You'd have to assume, okay, I have to assume every operation's going to, you know, access something in some way which will get confused. You know, that we're always reallocating the vector even when I'm just reading a value. And this is sort of the general rule that you're going to need to use for dealing with libraries. And you want to check, because sometimes there are surprising exceptions. And in fact, the C++ standard library has one of those. And that's vectors of bools. So normal vectors, if you're modifying different elements of the vector, just like an array, no problem. Like you'll get the if they're independently accessed, it's not a problem. You can like write element 0 and element 1, and they won't interfere with each other. Vectors of bools, not true. You can't safely read and write any two different elements at the same time. And this is because C++ allows that to be implemented by putting multiple booleans in one integer. You know, weird choice. And you wouldn't know that this is unsafe unless you actually checked the documentation to figure out, oh, vectors of bools don't work the way I want them to for using them for multiple threads. So questions on C++ containers and multiple threads? Okay. So something to note out here is that like both of these rules here, if you want to follow them, these are things that you can use locks for. So don't add or remove elements if no other threads are accessing. So you have you have a lock for access, add, or remove, so only one thread does that at a time. You might say, maybe we can do better. We'll talk about that probably next week. And similar for accessing an element versus modifying it, you can make sure only one thread does it at a time. That's sufficient to comply with this. And you might think, we could, there's something better we could do, and yes. Like we could allow multiple reads and only one write, but locks aren't a tool to do that. We'll have it. More sophisticated tools later, which will let us do that. Any questions before I move on to implementing locks? So let's talk about the simplest case for implementing locks, which is going to be a single core. And we've already kind of seen this when I talked about how the scheduler was implemented. So for implementing locks in a single core, the only thing we need to worry about is context switching. And the only reason unexpected context switches are going to happen is because of an interrupt, a timer interrupt, I/O happening, and so on. So how we're going to implement locks is when we don't want anyone else to run and acquire the lock, we're just going to disable interrupts sort of as a very thorough solution that while the lock is held, no one else gets to run, therefore no one else will try to get the lock. And most processors have instructions for this. So on x86, CLI is the disable interrupt instruction. STI is the enable interrupt instruction. Now, so this is our lock. There's some problems with this. So someone can give me some things that we won't like about this lock implementation, even if we just have a single core. Like, obviously, there are problems with multi-core, but even with a single core, there are going to be some issues with this lock that make it like not usable in general. Yeah? Yeah, so this is bad. So this can cause starvation. That one process can take up a lot of time that it shouldn't take up. Even though, like we talked about, having schedulers like avoid that, this will like throw that all out the window. And worse, if the process has a bug and doesn't unlock, nothing else ever gets to run ever. Any other issues? Yeah.
Would I/O be lost, or would that just be saved for I/O?
So the question is, what happens to I/O during the lock? While we have interrupts disabled. So the interrupt for I/O will happen when interrupts are re-enabled. So if that happens, we're great. But there's cases where that won't happen. So one example would be, let's say I acquire a lock and then read something from the disk. For that read from the disk to complete, I need to have an interrupt come in from the disk to tell the OS the read from the disk is done. But that won't happen. And I won't release the lock until I'm done reading from the disk. So that would be a big problem. Yeah, so we can't use this lock to have critical section that includes certain types of I/O. Yeah?
Is
there a race condition between jumping to the lock function and disabling the interrupts?
The question is, there a race condition between jumping to the lock function and disabling the interrupts? There is not, and the reason for that is because this is a single core, and the disable interrupts is one instruction. If it were more than one instruction, we would have to worry about that. Okay. Other questions? Or other possibilities, I should say, or questions? So the question is, how does this interact with system calls? And system calls aren't an interrupt for this purpose. Interrupts are only involuntary. So it won't affect them, except that because of the issue of starving other programs, we probably don't want to allow this in user mode. And in fact, disable interrupts instruction is only allowed in kernel mode, typically, for that reason. So yeah, so you mentioned you can hang the system, so that's a problem with this. You can't do I/O in the lock of some types, like reading from disk. There's another problem, which is a little more subtle, which is that we might have multiple locks. You know, so here I have a lock for the milk in the fridge and a lock for the store, and I have a lock for the store because other things want to use the store. And I want to have only one thing at a time so I don't get confused about what's in the store. And you know, the question is, when do we actually enable interrupts here? So in this example, it isn't actually a problem, but we have real examples in, say, XV6 where it comes up. So one case is that the XV6 has a system call to wait a certain amount of time, and this needs to acquire the lock for the process table to set the current program as sleeping, and the lock for the current count of the number of ticks that have passed since boot, the number of times a timer interrupt has happened. So those both have separate locks, and we want both of them. It's not clear how we make that work with this just disabling interrupts. So I'll start with these problems. So XV6 uses disabling interrupts like this as how it makes its locks work on a single core. There's some extra stuff it does to work on multi-core. And you might say, what about these problems? XV6's solution to these problems is that this is only in the kernel, and they rely on kernel programmers not making these problems. If you mess up, well, that's too bad. Now, for this nested lock issue, they have a different solution. So here is an excerpt of the acquire and release functions for XV6's spin lock. And it starts with a call to this push CLI and pop CLI function. And push CLI is a wrapper around the disable interrupts instruction, CLI. Pop CLI is a wrapper around the allow interrupts instruction, STI. And they need to be in pairs. And what push CLI does is it disables interrupts if they aren't disabled already. And pop CLI enables interrupts if the corresponding push CLI disabled them. So for example here, you know, we have a push CLI and a pop CLI, and these are going to be a pair. And we have a push CLI and a pop CLI. These are going to be a pair. And this one's going to actually disable, and therefore this one's going to enable. This one's not, and the ones in the middle aren't going to enable or disable interrupts. They're just going to leave things unchanged. And to track this, push CLI and pop CLI just have a counter. So questions? How that works. Okay, so that's clocks on a single core. We have a sufficient way of implementing locks in a single core. We're going to first talk about how we do it on multi-core before we get back to having locks which we can use outside the kernel with people who aren't writing code that we know won't hang and all that. But first, I want to talk about some coordinating between threads. So we mentioned that, well, it's really hard to make locks with atomic operations, but we at least had a way of doing that. And first I'm going to start with some bad news about what we thought was possible. And this is about how our atomic loads and stores don't do what we think they do. So here I have two threads. So thread one sets x, a global variable x, to 1 and returns y. Thread B sets a global variable y to 1 and returns x. And these both are run here with x and y initially 0. And they return, thread A returns y, thread B returns x, and we print out the return values of A and B. So what's one of the possible outputs that this could have? Any of the possible outputs. And in x86, it turns out that this is an atomic load and this is an atomic store. So it happens all at once. You don't have to worry about storing half of x, the bit by bit sort of scenario. So what results do we expect? Like, what's a result that could happen? Yeah.
A1, B1.
How would that happen?
Thread A returns 1 and thread B returns 1.
Okay. So we return 1 is what you're saying. I agree that this is possible. I want to know what executes to make this happen. So initially x and y are 0. So what happened to make them return 1? Someone else?
Move 1 into x and then move x into EAX.
Okay. Move 1 into x. And okay, so you're saying the move 1 into x happened and then the move into EAX happened. So you want this to happen. So you want this, then this, then this. Now, for the move X into EAX to happen, because the same thread has a move into Y, it has to be the case that the move into Y happens earlier.
Right.
So let's renumber here and say that we'll have a 2, 3, 4. Okay. And then we need to do the rest of A, 5, 6. And that indeed is a way of running this, where basically we have a context switch after the first instruction of A runs, and then we run thread B, and then we run the rest of A. So we have two context switches, one after the first instruction of A, one after B finishes, in order to make this order happen on a single core. And on the multiple cores, we just imagine that these operations are happening simultaneously. It's just a matter of when things get read or written. Okay? How about another possible output? So you started with the most complicated case, probably, right? Because we're context switching twice. There's cases where we context switch once. I'm going to give one of those. Yeah.
0, 1.
So how would that happen? So you're saying, so another case is that we have thread A run, then thread B, and that gives us 0, 1, or the other way around, gives us 1, 0. And yeah, so those are the possibilities we get. We got A1, B1, from the interleave, do the first thing, then do all the rest, and A before B, B before A. So I took this code, and I ran it on my desktop 100 million times. These are the results I got. So usually A executed before B. Some portion of the time I got B executed before A. Scheduler worked out a little differently. I very occasionally got that, split that was the first proposed output. And sometimes I got both zeros. Not very often, but sometimes. And you might look at this and say, is your processor broken? Is that not the real assembly code? But no, in fact, my processor is not broken. It is working exactly as documented, running exactly this code. And what's happening here is a subtlety about what I said about atomic loads and stores. These are atomic loads and stores. We do the whole load or the whole store, but I didn't tell you that the atomic loads and stores happen in order. And they don't. So my processor runs things out of order, like, because that's faster. Sometimes it's, you know, it's nice to not do the store right away. We can, you know, do it later when it, you know, let it finish while we're doing the load. That's nice and fast. And the processor, you know, makes sure that this doesn't affect results on a single core. And you would might say, okay, well, it should just make a multi-core work then. But the decision that most processors have made is that they're not going to bother. They don't do that. Within a thread on a single core, they're going to do it. But they said, if between cores, the programmer has to worry. Now, you might say, gosh, this makes doing anything with multiple threads seem really useless. So we're going to have some mechanisms for getting around this, obviously. Now, one thing we could do is that it's not a wild west in how the processor reorders things. There are, in fact, very specific rules that the processor manufacturer will tell you about when things are reordered. I don't want you to memorize these rules, because it turns out that reasoning about rules like this, here are the x86 rules, is extremely difficult. It's very hard to go from these rules, which are, turn out to be pretty useful even, but it's really hard to actually use these rules in a practice, you know, to figure out, does my program execute the way I think it does? And the rules are that each core sees its own loads and stores in order. By sees, I mean it's as if they executed in order, so the processor will hide the side effects from you within a core. And stores from other cores always appear in a consistent order, but a core can see its own store early. So the idea is, you know, that we'll send the store to other cores eventually, and we'll send it to all of them at once, but we might learn about it locally earlier. And there's this causality rule, which says that if a core reads a value and uses that to compute another value, other cores won't see the other value before the value that was read. You know, they're checking both of them back and forth, which is called causality. Yeah. And you can work from these rules and figure out, you know, how to make safe programs, but it's really tedious and has lots of corner cases. And usually, almost always, you won't want to do that. So instead, we're typically not. And we're going to rely on the hardware giving us special instructions to say, knock it off. Don't do this reordering. I want things to happen in, you know, one after the other. Please stop. And there's two forms of this. So one form is that there will be special instructions with strong and simpler ordering rules, like just one after the other. So there's like a version of store that is store, like, you know, in order with other things that are this version of store. So you don't have to worry about that. And there are special instructions that restrict the ordering of the instructions around them called fences. So the idea of a fence is that we have a fence instruction, and everything before the fence instruction happens on one side of the fence. Everything after the fence instruction happens on the other side of the fence. And we don't ever throw instructions across the fence as far as when they actually execute. So if there's a load before the fence, it actually happens before anything after the fence runs. Okay. So questions about this idea? Yes?
But the order within the fence can be out of order.
Yes, but the order on one side of the fence can be out of order, yes. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I told you processor gets in the way. And you might say, okay, well, that's pretty inconvenient. But, you know, at least on a single core, everything works the way I want. But turns out the compiler gets in the way, too. So here is sort of a C version of the sort of final version we had of the Alice Bob note sharing code. Alice writes a note, waits until Bob doesn't have a note anymore, and then does something. And let's look at the implementation of this wait until Bob doesn't have any note anymore loop that I got from my compiler. So what the compiler has done is it said, oh, you're reading this global variable over and over again. That's going to be really slow. I'll load that into a register for you. And it decided it will load it into a register before the loop, because it doesn't matter when you load before or after, you know, just doing it all before. Shouldn't change anything, but it does. So the compiler is going to compile its code by default, assuming there are no other threads. And because of that, it will do optimizations like this, which usually are a very good idea. But in this case, they get us into a lot of trouble. We have this loop, which is checking if our register is somehow changing from under us, which will never happen. So we need some way of telling the compiler to knock it off too. And this happens not just with loads, but with stores. So here is a modification of that code where instead of having note from Alice be one, I'm saying there's a note from Alice saying I'm waiting and a note saying that I'm done. You know, to maybe speed things up a little bit. And I compiled this, and what did the compiler decide to do? Well, it said, gosh, you're writing two into note from Alice after writing one, you know, the value is always going to be two. Why should I bother storing one there? So the compiler just said, we'll just store two at the end of the function, get rid of that store of one, that doesn't matter, because the compiler's assuming there's only one thread. So it just eliminated the write of two, one, thread B will never read one, and we write the two after we're done with everything, even though it seems like we shouldn't do that. Yes?
Does this happen without optimization flags, or does this specifically?
So the question is, does this happen without optimization flags? Generally not, but it happens with pretty much any sort of optimization flags. So we're going to avoid this, you know, other than by just disabling all optimizations. Other questions? Okay, so you might look at this and, you know, look at what I said about processor reordering and compiler reordering things and say, why did any of the pthreads examples you showed me work? You know, it seems like they're all broken, but happily, pthreads is going to help us out. So pthreads functions prevent reordering. So they have the special instructions and the special directives for the compiler to say, knock it off, don't do any reordering, please. You know, insert that fence instruction and so on, including like preventing optimizations, like keeping that value in a register. So if you want things to behave correctly, use the pthreads functions to coordinate between your threads. So if you're using mutex lock or create or join, pthreads will solve this problem for you by telling the compiler and the processor, hey, don't reorder things, make it work like I expect in that function. But you have to use the pthreads functions to coordinate between your threads. So questions on this idea? Now, the compilers also have a solution, which is that primarily to help with implementing things like pthread mutex lock, compilers do have, as of recently, support for accessing those special instructions that prevent CPU reordering, and also telling the compiler, hey, I'm using multiple threads here, don't do it. I'm going to show you what this looks like briefly. I don't expect you to use it on any assignments. We're going to use pthread stuff. But I want you to know it exists in case you want to go at a lower level. This is the sort of stuff you might use to implement pthreads. And as an alternative to like handwriting assembly, which you could also do, but probably would rather not if you can avoid it. So one example, as I mentioned, there's this fence instruction, which keeps things from being reordered. You can access that with the atomic header and this function here. And this inserts the fence instruction, which on x86-64 is called mfence in the loop. So we make sure that the store of note from Alice happens before we check note from Bob. And also tells the compiler that, hey, I'm doing something where I expect other threads to act. where this fence instruction is, so the compiler does not keep note from Bob in a register. It loads it every time, because it knows the fence instruction says something's going on with other threads. Optimizations won't work here. Some optimizations. So questions about this? There's also a version of these atomic functions which, rather than specifying sort of fence operations, specify, I want to atomically and in the order I write it down, do loads and stores. So here I say, I want to store one into note from Alice and load note from Bob. And because these are what the C++ calls atomics, it will guarantee that those happen in the order that I wrote them, that the load of B will happen every time, and it will happen after the store of A. And because the compiler knows that, it generates code which makes sure the store of A happens before we load from B with this fence instruction. And also, it doesn't store things in a register because it knows I want to load from note from Bob every time. Some questions about this? So now that we've talked about, you know, sort of the primitives we have a little bit for, you know, loads and stores and actual ordering, I'm going to go into like how are the processors actually connected, which is going to give us more insight into what sort of things are we going to have that are going to help us implement locks. So we're going to want things which are better than the fence instructions and loads and stores for implementing locks. And it's good to know, like, what can the processor give us easily? And to know about this, we need to think about how are the processors connected to memory. And typically, you know, well, not typically, but our model is going to be a shared bus. So in practice, there might be something more complicated than a shared bus, but a shared bus is sort of the simplest way that people have actually done. And the idea of this shared bus is that when CPU 1 wants to read or write a value from memory, it just sends it to memory on this bus. And everyone takes turns using this shared communication medium. There's some hardware way of ensuring they take turns. And the messages are tagged, so when CPU 2 sees a message for memory 1, it knows it's not for me. But it reads all the messages because it's just one shared wire. Okay, some questions about this design? Okay, so that's how we're communicating. And a big concern is going to be how this interacts with caches. So we're going to want to use caches. And hopefully in whatever prereq you took, you learned about we have caches on each processor that are kept close to the CPU. So we're going to want one per core, typically. And memory's slow, so you don't want to actually go to this bus all the time. Because if we go to the bus all the time, even if we have a cache, like that's most of the cost we're trying to save by having a cache, is that we don't want to talk on the shared bus all the time. And this is going to create a problem for keeping all the CPUs in sync. And this is an issue known as cache coherency. That here, I have CPU 1 and CPU 2. Mostly, they're dealing with independent data. But they have one value that CPU1's accessing that's also being accessed by CPU2. So maybe note from Alice or something would be that. And those are in its cache. And let's say CPU1 writes to a value in its cache. Our question has to be, well, when do the values change elsewhere? Now, a simple correct solution we could have to this is that whenever we write to that value, we update it in memory and CPU2 by sending a message on that shared bus. We just say, hey, everyone, set this address, A300, to 1101. And we could definitely do that, have what you may remember as a write-through policy. And that would work, but it's slow. It's part of why we wanted to have caches was to be able to cache writes. So this is not what we're going to do in practice. We want to do something more efficient, but we're going to have to do more bookkeeping to keep track of it. But the basis is going to be the same idea as if, you know, I can tell everyone about this write And we're going to take advantage of that in our strategy that uses bookkeeping. So we have a shared bus, and that means that if CPU 1 updates memory, everyone knows about it. Or if CPU 2 tries to read from memory, everyone knows about it. So we're going to do what's known as snooping the bus. We're going to spy on what all the other processors are doing, because that's just how our bus works, is that we already got that information. Let's just use it. And we're going to use that to keep all the caches up to date. So we're going to look at those messages and maybe add a few extra ones to clean up out-of-date information in the caches. But we're going to do it in a way where we're not going to take the simplest solution of sending every write, because that's going to be too slow. We're going to do something a little faster by doing extra bookkeeping. So questions about this idea of spying on all the what other processors are doing with the bus? So I said extra bookkeeping. So that means we're going to keep some extra information for every cache block. So each cache, for every block of data it's caching, it's going to store a little bit of extra information, and it's going to update this information based on how its cache is read or written, and based on things it hears from other processors doing through that bus. And each cache is going to have its own set of information, and it might have different extra metadata for a particular block than the other caches do, and that's okay. And we're going to say that each cache block is going to have one of three values for this metadata. So our three values are that it's modified. And what this is going to mean is that the value being stored may be different from memory. Doesn't have to be, but maybe. And we're going to guarantee that only the one cache has a copy of the value. No one else, no other cache has a copy. We're going to guarantee that. We're going to design how we update these states and when we send messages to ensure that that is always true. And this is going to get rid of our biggest concern, which was, what if I write a value and someone else has an old version? We're going to make that not happen by saying, when I write a value, no one else is going to have a version of that value. Our second state is going to be share, that the value is the same as what's in memory, so I don't need to worry about other people having the wrong version. And as the name share suggests, multiple caches are allowed to be in the shared state for a value. And we have a third state of invalid, which is, I don't have the value. This is just like, just as if I never stored the value. So those of you who remember some more detailed learning about caches may have remembered a dirty bit and a valid bit, and may think, gosh, these seem like the same information, and they can be. So questions about these states. So these are the states I want, and I just need to figure out how can I switch states and send information to make these properties true. So we're going to have this chart. So let's think about what we want to do in these particular cases. So if we don't have a value cached that's invalid and we want to read it, we're going to enter the shared state by asking on the bus, hence why things are in blue, hey, give me a copy of the value and get it from memory. Since we got it from memory, we know it's the same as anyone else's. And if we don't have a copy of the value, we don't need to worry about what if other people are reading or writing. There's nothing to care about there. If we don't have the value and we want to write it, we want to go to the modified state. So we need to send a message on the bus saying, hey, I'm writing the value, and make sure that everyone else gets rid of their copy of the value. If I'm in the shared state, and I hear someone else is writing, I need to go to the invalid state. They need to be the only one with a copy. So I need to do the other path of that, make sure no one else has a copy operation, saying, I heard you were writing, I'm getting rid of my version, it's going away. And if we want to write the value, we need to tell everyone that, hey, I have a copy. And now, so far, it seems like, gosh, we're selling everyone every time we're writing. How is this a savings over just write everything directly? And that's going to happen when we think about the modified state. So if I already have a value I've written to, and I want to write it again, let's say I incremented the counter to 101, I want to increment it to 102, I don't have to do anything. Because I know I would hear if someone read or wrote the value. And I only need to act if someone else actually tries to use the value, in which case I'll hear about it because they'll need to ask for a copy. So if someone tries to read the value, I'm going to say, oh, I have an updated version, and I'm going to make sure I write it before they get to read it, so they can get the current version that I had cached. If someone else wants to write the value, I'm going to update them about any changes to the value and then get rid of my copy. Okay. So questions I'll have about happened here. So like the big savings we had over just write everything on the bus is that we don't write to bus if updating modified version. So if we're updating a modified version, we just do it locally, and that's going to be where our big savings comes in, because most values no one else is going to care about when we're modifying that. Some questions? Yeah.
So why would hearing a read transition to a shared state?
So question is, why would we transition to a shared state on a read? Is this as opposed to transitioning to invalid or staying modified or what?
I'm just not sure why would the value update?
So when we hear a read, that means someone else is asking to read the value, and they want to read the current version of the value. So if we do nothing, they're going to read an old version of the value. So we need to keep that from happening. The only way we have to keep that from happening is to send the current value on the bus. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? So to go through an example, so here is the scenario we started with, and we're saying, what if CPU1 wants to update its copy of A300? So it's initially in the shared state. It's going to go to the modified state. But to do that, we're going to tell everyone, hey, I'm writing this value. And that's going to make CPU2 invalidate its copy, so we don't have out-of-sync versions. And we could potentially update memory. We don't have to. And turns out we usually won't, because that will save time. We do need to tell all the other processors, hey, I'm modifying this value. Get rid of your copy. Then if we modify it again, we don't need to do anything. So I can increment it from 101 to 102. Since I was already in the modified state, don't need to tell anyone about it. They already don't have a copy. We're good. Okay. Then maybe later on, CPU2 tries to read the value. Then we're going to say, oh, okay, you want to read this value. I have the most recent version because I modified it. I'm going to write it back in time for you to read it. Okay. And then you got to read it, and you got the correct version. Okay. So questions? Yes? Yeah?
What does write it back in time mean exactly? Like, how does it?
So the question is, how do we write it back in time? So there's some very important details about how we take turns using the bus that I haven't talked about here that are, you know, necessary to implement this correctly. So something needs to guarantee that we get a chance to go before it reads the wrong value. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
When you say hear read and read, what do you mean by that?
So hear read is someone else asked, like here. So CPU2 is reading, CPU1 hears a read. It hears that CPU2 wants to read the value. Does that answer your question? So I mentioned one of the ways we save time is by not writing values as they're modified. Another big savings, which is more subtle, is that when we're doing writes, the first time, we don't write the value to memory. We just say, hey, everyone, get rid of your copy. And we only write it out later. So this also saves a bunch of time, because we can send less on the bus, and that's faster. So questions? Yes. OK. So that here's a little exercise. So I'm saying we have three CPUs, which are using this modified shared invalid mechanism for cache coherency. And we have cache blocks that are 32 bytes. And so since they're 32 bytes, this means addresses 00 through 01F are in one cache block, 020 through 0x3F, and so on, all the way up to 0100 through 0101F, and so on, are all in the same cache block. So some of the, so for example here, address 1000 and 1008 are in the same cache block, so they'll access the same state information. So I'm asking, what's the final state of these two cache blocks, the 0x100 through 101F and the 0x2000 through 201F. These are the two cache blocks that we might have cached. What is their final state? I'll give you a minute or so. Answer. Whoops, that's not what I wanted to do. Someone have an answer to any part of this, any one of the states. Any one of them. No. OK, so I'll go through how I figured this out. So one thing to know is that what happens with one cache block doesn't affect another cache block. So I'll first look at just the accesses that touch this 1000 through 101F cache block, which are these. And initially, everything's invalid because the question said so. Then we read into CPU1, so it becomes shared. Then we read into CPU2, so they're both shared. Then CPU1 wants to write. And to write, we need to go into the modified state. And only one thing can be in the modified state at a time. And no one else can have a copy, so everyone else gets invalid. Then CPU2 reads the value. This means that now CPU1 needs to send it out to CPU2. So it goes to the shared state as it does that, because it knows it's not the only one with a copy anymore. And CPU2 reads that copy. And then CPU3 reads from a different part of the cache block, but it doesn't matter because the cache only knows about the whole block. It doesn't have track little pieces of it. Only tracks the whole thing. So it has to get the whole thing into there, and that's going to be in the shared state, so everyone is going to end up with the shared state. Okay. And for the other block, well, we only have two accesses to it. So the first one reads it on CPU1, so that's going to go into the shared state to read it. Everyone else doesn't have a reason to access it, so they're still invalid. And then CPU2 writes it, and remember, when we write, we go into the modified state, make sure no one else has a copy. So CPU2, modified, everyone else doesn't have a copy. And this is even though CPU2 is writing a different part than A-read, doesn't help us. We have to track the whole thing all together. So we end up with invalid, modified, invalid. Okay. So questions about this exercise? Okay. So I've shown you sort of the simplest, like, good version of cache coherency. There are extensions that many processors have. So there are things we can do, like we can track whether value is modified separately from whether other people have it. So we can have a state saying, I am the only one who has the value, but it's the same as memory, so I don't need to write it back at any point in time. We can send values directly between caches rather than having them written to memory and then read back. And we can also have a version of this which works without a shared bus. These are all things real processors do that you can learn about in an advanced computer architecture class, hopefully. Something that came up in this exercise is that when we access one part of a cache block, it affects the state of the whole cache block. And this leads to issues. If we have two processors accessing different parts of the same cache block, those can be independent. Like, we can have two elements of an array that happen to be in the same cache block, and we're accessing them separately. Things will work correctly, but cache coherency means that the writes are one at a time, because we have to get it in the modified state, write it, and then the other processor needs to get in the modified state, so they'll take turns writing. And you can actually observe this as a performance effect. So here I have some code where I have a pointer, and I use that pointer to sum up an array. And I do this from two different threads, and I access array element sum into array element 0 and array element some distance away with a variable distance. And if that distance means I'm in the same cache block, these are going to interfere with each other, even though I'm accessing different array elements. Like, I don't have any race conditions. I don't have any cases where I'll get the wrong answer, but things will be slow because under the hood, they're taking turns. That we're using this, hey, I want to write this cache block, get rid of it, and that will make me slower. And here I set up this array to start at the beginning of a cache block with this aligned thing. So we'll see how far into the cache block we need to get before this stops happening. And we can read from this chart, I have this slower performance when things are close to the beginning, close to each other. And when things get far enough apart, it gets faster. And what's happening here is that in this range, everything's in the same cache block. And my cache blocks happen to be 64 bytes. How about that? You can just read it off the chart. And then things get faster. And this is a problem which occurs by accident in real programs, because, you know, what I did to make this happen, well, I just decided that I'd do my two sums into two adjacent things in an array, which is a very reasonable choice, but it's really slow. And the fix, which seems like totally non-intuitive for performance, is to spread them out. Like, deliberately add unused extra space between the two values you're using in different threads. And that's really what people do. Okay. So questions about that? So questions about this. This is known as false sharing. You have two independent things that are really independent, but they're shared because of some implementation detail of the hardware, basically. And that causes bad performance, not incorrect behavior. So questions about false sharing? So I'll finish up by showing us how we're going to properly implement locks. And we're going to need some special instructions. And now that we know how we keep caches in sync, this is going to give us insight into how can the processor implement a useful special instruction for us. And these are going to be what we call atomic read, modify, write instructions. So this is an instruction that's going to read a value, modify it based on what it read, potentially, and then write a value without any other processor getting in the way. And we learned that we had this modified state where we know we have a value and no one else has it. So how are we going to implement this instruction in hardware? We're going to get the cache block containing the value in the modified state, do the operation, and make sure we don't let it go out of that state while we're doing it. So we actually have a very elegant hardware mechanism to provide this type of atomic read, modify, write, and this is what processors provide. So on x86, one of the atomic read, modify, write instructions is this atomic exchange, lock exchange, which takes a memory location and a value, and it swaps them. So we read from the memory location and put it into a register, and pick the old value of the register and put it in that memory location. And we do this without any other processors getting in the way. So we do this, you know, when we do this, no one else is doing it at the same time. And we can use this to implement a lock using a strategy known as test and set. So we exchange the value taken with a lock. So the instruction's going to write taken value, which we might use like 1 to represent taken. And we're going to read, was the lock already taken? So if we find out the lock was already taken, well, we successfully marked it as taken, but someone else got to it first, so we don't have it. If it was previously not taken, we know we're the gun who got it, and no one else did, because no processor could have snuck it in between because of how this instruction works, the special instruction. So questions? This high-level idea. I'll show you the code. So here's 64-bit x86 code that does this. So we have a global variable representing the lock. We're going to set it to 1 when the lock's taken, 0 otherwise. And we're going to say, let's put 1 in the lock and read the lock with this one special instruction and see, was the lock 0 beforehand? And if it wasn't, so the lock was already taken, then we're just going to try again, jump to the beginning, try again. And if it wasn't taken, we just finish, we got the lock, we're the one who changed it from 0 to 1. If we changed it from 1 to 1, we didn't get the lock, keep trying until we change it from 0 to 1. And to release the lock, we have a fence here to make sure we don't have any bad reordering, and then we just set it to 0. So first set the lock to 1 and read the old value, see if the old value was already locked. If so, retry until we set it to 1 from 0. So questions about how this works? Yeah?
So there's no timeout on acquiring, we'll just keep trying to acquire.
So this implementation of a lock, there is no timeout. This strategy is known as a spin lock because we can spin in that loop for a very long time. And this is in fact what XV6's spin lock does. So this is what XV6 does in addition to disabling interrupts to handle multiple cores. So something to note, I showed you one atomic operation. There are others. So for example, x86 also has a what's called compare and swap, which without any other processor getting in the way, says if this memory location had a particular value, set it to this new value. Otherwise, don't do anything to it and tell me what you did. Or add to this memory location and tell me what it was before I added. So there are other atomic instructions. They're all useful. I just went over sort of the simplest one and how we can use them to implement a type of lock. So next time, we'll talk about problems with this. And you got to one, which is that we can keep looping for a long time. We'll talk about fixes for those sorts of problems.